zero delinquency. Yeah, not one penny in delinquency, which is great. And we're not tied to long-term contracts. You know, it's not like I'm not waiting 12 months to reset like some of our multifamily assets are. It's like, well, we just reprice it tomorrow because we need to.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Hey, welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. I'm your host, Tate Duryea. I'm here with Sam Wilson of Bricken Investment Group, and it's just us today. Ryan is on a property tour. He is taking his new president of Free Up Storage, which is their national storage brand, on the tour of their West Coast properties in Oregon and Washington. He's got a Cirrus, and they're he rented a Cirrus, and he's down there checking that out. So it's just Sam and I wrapping today. Sam, what's up, man? It's so great to have you on the show.
Tate, good to see you, man. Absolutely great to see you. And I really pity Ryan, you know, having to struggle with flying a Cirrus around the West Coast. Must be tough.
Yeah, it must be real tough. I was like, yeah, that doesn't sound too bad. So I'll pick up the slack today.
Exactly. We'll let him foot the fuel bill, but we'll pick up the slack here.
I love it. Well, Sam, we've been friends for many, many years. We met, I think, at a best ever conference in Denver, maybe 5-6 years ago or something like that. And we've sort of been tracking each other's journey. Sam has an amazing podcast called the
How to Scale Commercial Real Estate.
How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. I think I was a guest on that not too long ago, maybe a year or something like that. Yeah. Excellent show. It's a weekly show. Definitely check that out. But Sam, thanks for coming on. This guy is a wealth of knowledge on real estate. And I just want to get into all of your investing journey and unpack sort of your path and what you're doing now and help the listeners understand sort of what the possibilities are in this space.
Sure. Yeah. Happy to chat. And, you know, I don't know how much time we have here today, but it's probably not enough to unpack my entire real estate investing journey, but happy to take this anywhere you like here, Tate. So right. You tell me where to kick it off. And we'll go there.
Well, let's start at the beginning. How'd you get into real estate in the first place?
I always say it was the good Lord having mercy on an idiot, Tate. That's the truth. I sold a business in Indiana. I had no college degree. I didn't know what to do next in life. I had a pocket full of money and time. Now, mind you, I've only worked for myself my entire life. So, you know, I'm 30 years old. I'm completely unhirable, right? Like, who hires a guy that's never worked for anyone else? And I had no idea what to do next because I'd only worked in one industry. Sold that business. I knew I hated the cold. I headed south. My wife's from Tennessee. So we landed in Middle Tennessee. And one day I was scrolling through the foreclosure auctions and I saw a foreclosure auction coming up. This was in 2013, back when those were prevalent still. Anyway, 2 hours later, I owned a house. I bought it at the foreclosure auction and that was my introduction into real estate.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I walked in the living room and I asked my wife, Elizabeth, I'm like, I looked at the house, you know, I drove down, looked at the house, I came back and I said, hey, you mind if I buy a house today? And she's like, no. So I did. And we made a pile of money on it. And I said, man, we can keep doing this. This is a good idea. So I never wanted to get into real estate until that day. And I haven't looked back since.
Let's jump into that for anybody that doesn't know what a foreclosure auction is or how it works. And first of all, was that Memphis?
Nah, that was in a little town, or just say Coffee County, little county.
Okay.
In Middle Tennessee. There's really no major cities anywhere in Coffee County.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. You're in Memphis now, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So anybody who is based there with FedEx, definitely look up Sam and try and buy him a beer. So foreclosure auctions, how do these work?
Yeah, that's a long conversation. And I got really lucky in that what we bought was not, I wasn't the proud owner of a second mortgage, which you can do at a foreclosure auction. Mm-hmm. There weren't a bunch of IRS liens against it. There weren't all these things that kind of dirty up the title, right? That could have made that deal really sour. I ended up buying a house. It was a first position lien that was being foreclosed on. I bought the house and it was just off to the races. No big deal. And a foreclosure auction, of course, is when somebody just doesn't pay their mortgage. I mean, they stop paying their mortgage, and the bank then, and every state kind of handles this in different ways. So we won't get into the nuances of what those are, but in the state of Tennessee, they require an attorney to then go to the auction block, which here in Tennessee, it's handled at the courthouse steps. So you literally just walk up to the courthouse steps, and there's a guy looks just like you in a golf shirt sitting there reading off a bunch of papers, selling houses. I mean, you'll watch millions of dollars at a time trade hands right in the courthouse steps like it's 150 years ago. It's like, what is going on here? The weirdest thing, I think, still of just how that process works. But yeah, I literally was out in the courthouse steps, and I was the only bidder at the auction. So the guy's like, hey, whatever the price was. And I'm like, a dollar over. There was nobody else there to bid against me. Yeah, no, times have changed. On that front, yeah, there's 100 people at that auction now. So that's a different deal.
Well, all right. And I don't want to get too deep into that, but if people want to find out more about foreclosure auctions, do you have any good places that they can go?
Yeah, it's a tough one because there's a lot of misinformation, I will say, out there. I don't really like that word, but anyway, there is a lot of incorrect information out there. Mm-hmm. About foreclosure. You go to a website, not to bash anybody, but you go to foreclosure.com. Those are true after auction foreclosures. So now the bank has already taken those houses back. You are buying a house that's already been foreclosed on. I guess I should call them pre-foreclosure auctions, because what I was buying on was before the bank had completely taken it back.
Got it.
But that's data. I mean, I would oftentimes see houses on foreclosure.com that had sold 2 weeks ago at auction that I was at. I'm like, why is this on this website? This data is so outdated. I don't know how they stay in business, to be honest with you. As someone who's in that space for many years, I never quite understood their model. So I'm like, this is worthless information. So a lot of those are listed. If you want to just start to get a feel for it, many states, again, are 150 years behind the times. So you can get in your local newspaper and look up the ads in the ad section, and it'll be listed under public notices. So you'll start to see all these public notices. And I hired VAs and all kinds of people to scour those ads and build spreadsheets for us and tell us when they were happening. Cause there was just no way to track it except for through your local newspapers, which is kind of crazy, but it's the way it works.
Well, so do you still do that, or did you take a different path?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. You know the answer to that question, buddy. In 2018, I mean, we were hot and heavy into housing. We, you know, of course, then started buying, we were all doing all single family houses and started doing a bunch of online marketing, buying stuff through Google Ads, launching websites, started doing a bunch of flipping. And in 2018, which, how wrong was I? That's one of the things you'll learn along the way, is that I was like, my gosh, I feel like everything's overbought. Mm-hmm. And this was especially true here in the Memphis market. Hedge funds had come to town. I mean, they were paying 98 cents on the dollar for stuff they'd never even seen the inside of. And it's like, I can't, as the small investor on the block, I can't compete with that. I can't absorb that risk because I don't have $100 million to come spend in the city of Memphis. And be like, okay, well, we lost $10,000 on that house. $10,000 still means a lot to me. And so I just couldn't compete with the big guys anymore. And I also felt like there was looking for something that I could scale. And there's people that have figured out how to scale the single family rental game, but that's in my opinion, it's a slow game to scale. I mean,
it is. I feel like most people,
even now, you're buying something. I mean, what do you?
Right. I mean, most people tend to graduate out of the single family home market as they mature as an investor, right?
Yep. Even passive investors, I feel like. Right. Graduate out of that game. Like, yeah, you know, I own five of them, and then I sold those off, and now I'm a passive investor into larger, you know, commercial real estate syndications, just for the same reasons that we are the active investors in those, is that they're scalable, is that their returns are more meaningful. Generally, the return on time is greater, the return on investment potential is greater. You're no longer trading on comps, you're trading on net operating incomes.
Absolutely.
You know, so those are a lot of the reasons I said, look, I got to get out of this. Started buying parking lots and parking garages, which was great all the way into the pandemic. And then the pandemic happened. Right. Good timing, buddy.
Yeah.
Which we sold in January of 2020. And we avoided buying some really large portfolios, actually, in January of 2020. And so I came out of that smelling like a rose. But yeah. I also kind of lost momentum, because it was really in 2020. It's like, okay, we can't buy anything. We can't underwrite it. I mean, who was paying for parking?
Right.
Nobody. Who was paying for parking across the U.S.? Nobody. I mean, parking garages were empty. Banks weren't loaning on it. There's no, again, back to the bonus, or back to the blessing of commercial real estate trading on net operating income. There's no net operating income to even underwrite.
Right.
Like, oh, well, look, we've gone 8 months without a dollar in revenue. Congrats.
Right. Well, and let's stop on the parking lots and parking garages quickly, because this was something we discussed years ago, was this strategy. And I thought it was really interesting because it's basically a covered land play, right? It's, you know, you're buying it for the dirt, but it produces some income in the meantime. And I thought that was a really cool strategy. So you want to just sort of unpack that now that the pandemic's over? That might be a strategy, you know, some listeners out there might be interested in. What are your thoughts on it?
Oh man, if I had the bandwidth to go back and start underwriting and looking at parking again, I would. We've obviously shifted strategy in a very meaningful way since then, and so it's just not in the cards. But yeah, it is a covered land play a lot of times, because you'll find maybe it's a 10,000 square foot parking lot in a central business district, and you know, just right for someone to buy, hold it, collect the cash flow in the meantime, and then somebody else comes along and buys it for redevelopment prices. Right. So you're not trading. We would buy it on net operating income basis. The next guy wants to buy it on a square foot basis,
right?
Which is fantastic, because they're like, well, shoot, I want to put an office building, I want to put a restaurant, I'll put something else here that's going to be highest and best use of this. So yes, it was absolutely a covered land play. Parking garages, maybe not as much, just because they are incredibly expensive to build and incredibly expensive to tear down. So it's, those aren't as much covered land plays, but they are still very, very cool assets that, I mean, the thing I loved about parking was that your phone would never ring, even as the active sponsor. Like you'd buy it, you'd plug an operator in on it, and the operator would take care of it. And it's like, what's it, especially a parking lot, is like, my joke was always, what's it going to do? Flood? We'll just bring the water to get down. I mean, I have no risk. Almost no risk. And your return profiles were adjusted accordingly. I think we generally shot for like an 8% annualized return, which is not going to blow your socks off for most investors.
And that's including sale, right? That's not 8% cash on cash on an annualized basis. It's certainly not in a major metro.
Right. Well, I mean, that's what you'd underwrite for the hold period, for cash on cash annualized return. You know, we never really underwrote what it would look like if we sold, because we didn't really raise a lot of money for it at that time and didn't really care. We just wanted to clip the coupon.
Right.
But that said, I forget where I was going with all that. But yeah, the strategy there was definitely the covered land play. And I'll give you kind of some hints on how we would find those assets, if that's of interest to you. And maybe because I know you have a lot of listeners, I think, that either, passive income pilots, they have time on their hands in various cities around the country. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought this was, I think I know where you're going with this. And this is something that I think a lot of listeners will find kind of a fun concept, was, is this the bicycle around the city?
Yeah, exactly. Yes,
we have layovers all the time in different cities. And I've heard the strategy, and I've heard it debunked as well, where guys are like, my plan was to buy a house in every layover city, and then I did it, and then it was a management nightmare because I've got houses all over the place and tenant issues everywhere. So maybe you want to think twice about it. But I do, for anybody that's interested in buying some investment property where they're laying over, I love this idea. So Tim, you want to kick that off?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, you can do it with a bicycle, you can do it with a car. The problem for me on the parking lot deal was that they were concentrated in a very small area. If you went to downtown Cincinnati, it's like, okay, Cincinnati's not that big, but still it's, you got a mile by 2 mile, maybe 2.5 by 2.5, call it max area that you're looking at buying parking lots in. But if you're going to drive your car up and down those streets and mark off where the parking lots are so you can skip trace and research who the owners are and reach out to them, you just can't do it. So I would throw my bike in the trunk of my car, drive to that city, get my bike out, and then I could just mark on Google Maps, just pin after pin after pin of everything I wanted to do. I'd pull up, stop, like, okay, that's a parking lot. That's cool. Drop a pin on it. Okay. Go another 100 yards, find something else, drop a pin on it. You do the same thing. It's like driving for dollars, just on two wheels, not four. And it was very, very effective. I actually really, really enjoyed that. But I think, like you said, people, if you've got time in each city, maybe it's not an effective strategy buying one rental house in 50 cities. That just sounds like a management nightmare. But certainly that idea of, even if you're looking at commercial assets, like, get out in that city, drive, go look, go get a feel. I think I went to Miami here in January to look at some stuff with some people, and I did the same strategy. I said, guys, if we're here, we like this building, that's cool, but we're all going to rent bikes and we're just going to go ride for like 3 hours. We rented those, you know, you can rent bikes now in almost every city. I learned so much just from that slow play, riding around, looking at different assets, seeing where people are, who congregates there, what rivers run through the city. And it was just very, very enlightening. And I think if you're looking to get into real estate, you can learn a lot just by that, absorbing what's around you, you know, kind of approach. And without any clear, I didn't have any objective for it right. in January. I had no objective other than to just go understand. And I think that's really, really helpful. And even as a passive investor, I mean, shoot, I visit most projects before I invest in it. It's yep. crazy. We can get into that, but I know it's a left turn from where we are right now. But it anyway, that was my strategy. I hope you find that helpful.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I love the bicycle thing because, you know, in a car, especially in a city, you know, you got people honking at you and there's nowhere to park, and it's it can be really difficult. Whereas on a bike, you can just hop off and walk around and stop anytime you want. Yep.
Yeah, you're moving too fast in a car to really, I think, get a feel for a place. But on a bike, like you said, you can stop 100 times and nobody cares.
Exactly.
And really get a boots on the ground feel.
You said that you contacted the owners and you skip trace them. What does that mean?
That's industry jargon. I'm sorry. A lot of these actually almost all commercial assets are held in an LLC name. Mm-hmm. And piercing that corporate veil can be very challenging. I use some paid services that cost me, you know, maybe $300 to $500 a month, where I could get access by and large to a lot of that data. But even then, it wasn't that clean, just because owners intentionally, myself included, obscure who I am that actually owns the asset. Like, you might have an LLC that owns this particular asset, and then inside of that, I have another LLC that is the managing partner of that LLC. So now you don't have one. Now you've got two LLCs to get through and figure out. Mm-hmm. And that LLC is the managing partner. I might have a registered agent that then takes care of managing all the registrations and everything for that LLC. But so by the time you've done all your homework, you might just wind up with some, you know, office on the 15th floor of some random city. You're like, okay, I'm never going to find out who actually owns this LLC. And trying to figure out, I would say we were 80% effective. It was pretty much an art. There's not a great service out there even today that's really good at figuring out how to do that. So I just kind of refined my craft and then taught some people that could understand what it was I was doing. And it took me several people trying to teach them how to do it. And it had to be the right person with the right inquisitiveness to keep asking questions. Like, oh, okay. There's 123 Main Street. And that is, you know, Tate's LLC. Well, gosh, 123 Main Street, Tate's LLC. And then you find something else, you find another random address. So then you reverse engineer who lives at that address. And you might see a T. Duryea lives at that address. You're like, okay, well, maybe that's the same guy. Okay, well, let's research and see who T. Duryea might actually be. And then you find out it's Tate Duryea. Then you start skipping through and finding all the numbers associated with Tate Duryea. It might be 20 of them, and you call all of them until you get Tate to pick up the phone. It was that complicated. Yeah. But it worked. I mean,
that's
it worked.
Great. What was the success rate once you got somebody on the phone? Because, I mean, this is one of the things with real estate that, you know, this is why I love investing passively, is because, you know, all of these strategies sound really simple on the front end, right? It's like, yeah, you know, you drive for dollars, you look at some properties, you find the owner, you call them up, you make some offers. But when you really look at where the rubber meets the road, it's a lot of hard work.
It's a lot of hard work. Yeah. And not everything is that really convoluted. But it is when you're finding owners to your point, it is a lot of hard work. I forget what I was going to say there, but it is exactly that.
Well, in any case, great strategy to rent a bike in a layover city if you're looking for an investment property, particularly if you're trying to, you know, set up an Airbnb or a long-term rental property, just to have some physical assets in your portfolio. It's a really good strategy. So, all right. Yep. So after the parking lot thing, I know you've transitioned since then, and this is in conjunction with I know the first time we met, your wife told me, she goes, I'm building a laundromat empire.
Yeah.
And I'm like, That's pretty cool. I don't think I've ever heard anybody say that before. Those two words together, laundromat and empire. So, yeah, tell us about this.
Yeah. So in the last 2 years, we've invested in a lot of different stuff. I've done deals with you. I've done deals with, you know, we've been capital partners on a lot of projects, which has been really fun for me. It's a side of the business I enjoy. And yes, Elizabeth, we've owned one laundry facility for 5 years, and it's just done amazing. I mean, I don't know why, Tate. I'm a slow learner. I didn't do real well in school. I'll be honest. It was not my, I don't think I'm stupid. I'm a slow learner. So that said, I have to learn at my own pace, but, we've done a bunch of different deals here in the last couple of years. We've been, you know, we're partners on multifamily projects, self-storage, land. I've got three RV resorts now that we own. We bought three RV resorts last year, which were fun. Those are great cash flowing assets. They kind of parallel actually what we're doing in the laundromat space. Mm-hmm. But here at the end of 2022, I started looking around. I'm like, gosh, man, like I've got this one store, just one single store that we took from doing $4,000 a month to over $40,000 a month in gross revenue with less than $100 in traditional marketing. That's it. Like we just, we're kicking butt and taking names. And to me, I have no investors in this store with me, so I can tell you what our average return profiles, but it's 25 to 30% annualized cash on cash return to me.
That's incredible.
And even on top of that, it takes me about 2 hours a month to run the store. I'm like, oh my gosh. Like,
so tell us the story. How'd you find this thing? How'd you buy it?
Do you want the truth or do you want the sanitizer?
Whichever one you think is more fun.
The truth is I spilled whiskey on a comforter. All right.
Uh-huh.
And being an opportunist, and this is the problem being entrepreneurial, is that we see opportunity everywhere. And this is something I've talked to, and this goes back to 2022, the end of 2022. So this all will tie together. But one thing I think that entrepreneurs struggle with is that we always see opportunity. Like, oh yeah, we could do that. Oh, we could do this. We could turn that into a pile of money. That'd be a blast.
Shiny object syndrome.
Shiny object. And also just like this, it's always exciting to do something new. So I'm in the middle of flipping houses in 2018. I think we did 18 or 20 houses that year. And I spill whiskey on a comforter one night and I get to get on my phone to find the closest laundromat. I don't know where a laundromat. I don't go to laundromats, right?
Right.
Find a laundromat. It's about a mile and a half from my house. I drive there the next day. I've got this, you know, stinking comforter now that I got to take in there. I'm like, hey, you know, and the place was disgusting. I mean, like lights hanging in, cockroaches on the floor, the fuzzy TV in the back. Like you feel like you're about to catch a disease or get stabbed. You're like, oh my gosh, what am I doing in this place? I just need to wash a comforter and get out. And I look around and I go, wait, this looks just like another housing flip. Like this place is awful. Like this needs a renovation. And so I asked the lady there that was working there. I'm like, hey, you have any idea who owns this place and if he'd ever want to sell? She was, I don't know. Here's his phone number. 3 weeks later, I owned a laundromat. That's
It's kinda... All right. How much did you buy it for? Did you buy cash? Did you finance it?
No, I paid cash for it, and it was 25 grand that I paid, which is basically just a purchase of whatever remaining. Yeah, whatever remaining equipment he had left that worked, because you got to remember that 80% of the equipment in there didn't function anymore. I mean, it was that bad, which is still the case.
And what about the
case across the?
What about the space? So it's leased. So you're not actually buying the.
It's a leased space. Yeah, I mean, I'd love to buy the building if I could.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Got it. So you're buying the remaining equipment that works for 25K.
Yep. Yep.
And then the name.
Well, yeah, we changed the name, but yeah,
okay.
We changed the name. And then, you know, in short order, we put about $100,000 in remodel expense of our own money into the store. And then we put about $100,000 in equipment into the store. And it was like, all of a sudden we started seeing this thing turn around. We're like, oh, wait.
Did you do any research ahead of time on demand and demographics and that sort of stuff? Or did you just jump in?
No. Absolutely not. No, we do it very differently now. Like now I'm like, man, I got to have my demographic studies. I got to have my industry reports. I need to know how many people I need to know. I want to know, like, you know, within a half a mile, how many households are single parent. I want to know, you know, racial demographics. I want to know average income. I mean, I need to know everything now.
Right. So right. Do it differently
now, but it's kind of like buying the foreclosure where it's like, I don't know. We'll just give it a shot. I mean, what's the worst thing I'm going to do? Fail. I mean, I got 25 grand in it. I'm not going to go broke.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I won't enjoy it, but I'm not going to go broke. So that said, you know, we put, so let's call it all in. Maybe we had 125 grand in it. And in about 13 months, we had all of our capital back. I'm like, okay, well, wow, this is working. And we have since then, you know, gone on to completely remodel the store. I've got probably $600,000 in equipment now in that store. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we run a robust delivery service. We've got, we do a ton of drop off. We handle some major accounts, you know, like Airbnb. We got whole Airbnbs, like, you know, customers that do like 50 Airbnbs at a time, and they're just constantly dropping stuff off at our store. We're fully attended. The place is brightly lit. So that's store number one. It's just, I mean, kicking butt and taking names. And that's how I got into the laundry business. And so at the end of 2022, I started looking around and I'm like, gosh, where else am I getting returns both on my time and on my investment like this? Right. Even in RV parks. We bought another RV park in the middle of December and we were pretty excited about it. Going in cap rates of 15 cap, which is on commercial real estate. Right. So for those of you who are listening, what a cap rate is basically just a percentage of your purchase price compared to what its annual operating or net operating income is. So a 15 cap on $1 million property would mean it's throwing off $150,000 a year in net operating income for those that might not quite follow that.
And for anybody just without context, typical cap rates for multifamily, self-storage, things like that are anywhere between 3.5 and 6.5 today. So a 15 cap is astronomical.
Astronomical, right? So a 3.5 to 6.5 would be $35,000 to $65,000 on that same $1 million purchase of net operating income. Right. So we're buying it with $150,000 net operating income on $1 million purchase, which is fantastic. I was excited about that. But even we got that deal done, and I realized how much work we're putting into it. And I go, my laundry business over here is not costing me much time, and the return on investment's insane. Why don't I own 100 of these?
Right?
Why not? Why don't I own 100 of these? Well, 10 of them would make a meaningful difference in anyone's life. 100 is just incredible. So the industry is no different than it was really in 2018. I mean, it's still like the last store we just bought, the five closest stores to the one we just bought, I wouldn't wash my dog in, let alone my clothes. And of course, I've contacted all the owners and they're not ready to sell because they're hanging on to it for Lord knows why. But lack of sophistication. The lights are hanging down. The place is filthy, dirty. They're unattended. They don't have a phone line. There is no website. There is no drop off. There's no delivery service. Their machines are 25 years old. The owner, the last owner, he was so proud. God bless him. He's probably 65, but he was like, you know, for 22 years, nobody else has ever touched. And this is another thing that we're changing. He goes, no one else has ever touched my coin boxes, you know, because they're still putting quarters in machines, which I don't understand either.
Right.
We are way, way, way beyond quarters at this point. Right. But he's like, nobody else has ever touched my coin boxes. I've always emptied all my own change machines. I'm like, so for 22 years, three times a week, you spend an hour and a half in here emptying quarters.
Right.
Oh my gosh. I haven't emptied quarters in so long. I mean, I did it for the first like 3 months and then immediately found a way to systemize that. Like, man, we're going to get an employee to handle that. I'm wandering all over the place here, but it's just enormous opportunity in that space.
This is great. I mean, this is like one of those things where I think that, you know, you're turning over rocks. And I think that, you know, certain people have this skill of turning over rocks and seeing what works. And for anybody listening, you know, Sam bought a foreclosure without knowing anything about foreclosures, you know, got his hands dirty, figured it out. Bought a laundromat without knowing anything about laundromats, got his hands dirty, figured it out. So many people spend time in analysis paralysis and, you know, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't work. And they analyze it to death and then they decide not to do anything. And they wait another few years before taking any action. I can't tell you how powerful that is of a lesson to take away from this, to just pull the trigger. Just pull any trigger and maybe it doesn't work out, but you know what? You're either going to succeed or you're going to learn.
Right. Or both. I mean,
or both.
Right. Right. And not all of my successes have been so, or not everything I've done this to has been rosy. I can tell you how to lose money. I mean, it happens in the same methodology where you don't know what you don't know, but I think building that, and I've never bet the farm on anything in particular. It's not been like, all right, we're going to go all in. This is everything I've got. And come hell or high water, we'll just see if this, you know, works or doesn't work. I've always taken kind of a measured approach. Like, okay, you know, I could lose the 25 grand on the laundromat and it's not going to change my life any. I won't enjoy it. but it's not going to change it. So I guess there is some strategy to that, but it definitely doing something is, man, that's so, yeah, that is, you got to move forward. If you're analyzing deals as a passive investor, educate yourself as much as you can and then get involved, do a deal.
Yeah, exactly.
Do a deal. And, you know, and I've done some deals as a passive investor, even that probably aren't performing the way that was underwritten.
Yeah.
If at all. And
same.
You learn lessons. Yeah.
You learn lessons from it.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about consolidation, because this is something that we saw or we've seen over the past, you know, really even before I was investing in real estate, you know, a decade and a half ago. The multifamily space has seen massive consolidation. Self-storage is seeing massive consolidation. Mobile home parks, massive consolidation. So what does that mean? And what are you seeing now in the laundry business that's sort of mimicking that?
Yeah, so it hasn't happened yet. And I think that's the fun part for me, is that I feel like we're on the front end of it. There's only one other person I know that is starting to syndicate and package up laundry facilities in a portfolio style, right? At least bringing a professional approach to it.
And real quick, what we mean by consolidation is just going from fragmented mom and pop ownership, where there's lack of sophistication, people have owned these things forever, to sophisticated operators coming in, building big portfolios, streamlining operations, bringing economies of scale and sophistication to the operation, and driving value.
And that's exactly what we want to do in this space, is consolidate.
Right.
And that's, the opportunity is there. I mean, shoot, even, you know, we're seeing it in car washes, even, is that right? Consolidation approach. There's one brand of car wash here in Memphis that, I mean, they just bought up. I was all the way to Oklahoma here this past week, and it was the same brand. I was like, right. And it happened like overnight. Like, I don't know. I'd love to look up what the transaction size was, but it was pretty substantial to all of a sudden see this same brand in a matter of about 30 days, just completely rebrand every store within a 500 mile radius of here in the car wash industry. We've seen Tide start coming into this space, which tells you something. Like, when Tide starts branding their own laundromats, you know, there's something there.
You're like, the detergent brand.
A detergent brand now is buying, there's Tide laundromats. I've only seen them in Chicago, and I saw one in Fort Worth. I need to probably, not Fort Worth, strike that, Fort Myers, Florida. And I need to probably start researching that more before I go on a podcast and talk all about it. But I've seen personally several Tide branded stores, and it's like, oh, why is Tide getting into laundromats? That's interesting.
Yeah.
So you're starting to see some more institutional capital enter the space, but not a lot of it. And back to your point, yeah, I mean, the average laundromat owner owns 2.6 stores. They do all the work themselves. They're still doing their machine repairs. They are still working the front counter in order to save on labor costs. They're still just, I mean, it's all of those things you just mentioned, that they're tired, they're old, they don't want to put. And that's the other thing, is that the cost of new equipment, I mean, we're retooling a store right now. And maybe this number won't be shocking for people investing in multifamily and, you know, spending $100 million on a multifamily property, but in the laundromat space, and for that mom and pop owner that's 60 years old thinking about plunking down another $600,000-$700,000 back into their store for new equipment, it's kind of daunting. Right. They're like, oh man, that's a lot of money, and it's going to take us a long time. They think in terms of, how long is it going to take us to pay off that loan, and do I want to be 70 paying off that loan? I'm like, man, you can't afford not to put in $700,000 in new equipment. Like, it needs to go in now. Like, right. You can't afford not to have brand new payment systems. Like, going back to the quarters thing, it's like, why are we taking quarters still? It's not 1965. It's not. Like, we can pay with our phone. You guys aware of this? We can pay with credit card. We can pay with debit card. We can do laundry loyalty cards. There's a lot of different things you can do to, when I say not just consolidate the space, but consolidate in a meaningful way, you know, that then drives revenue such that larger institutions later on will be interested in acquiring and getting into or buying a portfolio of stores that, like you said, are professionally run. So yeah, it's really, really low hanging fruit right now in the space. I don't think it's going to last forever, especially not with the return profiles we hit, but that's what I'm seeing right now on the consolidation front.
That's really interesting. Wow. What about depreciation? What about the tax benefits from this stuff? Because, you know, and we're going to do a deep dive with Toby Mathis from Anderson Advisors, for anybody listening, backed by popular demand. It's going to be next, I believe, sometime next week. And we're going to do a deep dive on depreciation and how all that works. But in real estate, any of the, when we do a cost segregation study on, let's say, a multifamily building, you know, commercial real estate is depreciated over 39 years, but we can break out certain components, drive aisles, roofs, countertops, appliances, flooring, things like that, into 5, 7, and 15 year accelerated depreciation buckets. And then we can bonus that in year one. Last year and for the past 5 years have been 100% bonus depreciation for anything in those categories. This year, it starts phasing out. 2023, it's 80%. Next year, it's 60, and then 40, and then 20. Bonus depreciation has been around, you know, many times in many forms over the last, you know, decades, through many presidential administrations. It's just a lever that the government can pull to sort of spur economic growth. But when you get into assets like mobile home parks, car washes, and I'm assuming laundry facilities, all of that equipment falls into the shorter, I'm not sure which accelerated depreciation bucket, but it's bonusable, right?
Yeah, yep, it is. It is. And depending on, yes, is the short answer, is that it is. So it's 7 year, I think.
That sounds reasonable.
Yeah, on a 7 year schedule. So yeah, we can bonus depreciate the heck out of that, especially, you know, if we're buying the buildings along with it, you know, we'll do depreciate or do your cost segregation studies and capture as much of that depreciation as you possibly can. So yeah, you're going to look at a nice healthy loss, healthy paper loss on right. your K-1 there in the first year, which is helpful. It may not be as amazing as, you know, some other things, because it's just not the size of transactions maybe that you'd have in a 10 or 20, $30 million multifamily property. But, right. you know, on a dollar for dollar basis, it's still very good.
Yeah. On a dollar for dollar basis, it's still excellent. And, you know, this is one of the things that land is not depreciable.
Right.
The structure is depreciable. So the more value that there is in the structure and the more components that you can pull out into these accelerated schedules, the more aggressive your K-1 is going to show a phantom loss, which can really benefit. We'll get into that with Toby, but yeah, so some of these more alternative asset classes can provide some incredible depreciation benefits. Well,
that's exactly right.
Sam, is there anything else you wanted to touch on before we sort of bring this thing home?
Man, I don't think so. I think that's a lot of talking about laundromats. We've talked about depreciation. We've talked about the opportunity. We've talked about, I think we talked a little bit about the technology that comes into the space. Yeah, it's just a fun spot to be. I think, you know, one of the last, maybe we haven't talked about just the recession resistant, inflation resistant aspects. I think.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because that's important. You know, I mean, everything that we focus on, everything that we go after with Turbine is very much trying to decouple ourselves from market volatility and decouple mm-hmm. ourselves from market cycles in terms of boom and bust. So yeah, recession resistance is always on our mind. What does that mean? What does that term mean, and how do laundromats fall into that?
Yeah. So behind food and shelter, the third thing most humans want is clean clothing. If you right. think about that, it's like clean clothing. I would say that for items of inelastic demand, you know, cigarettes and alcohol probably rank right up yep. there yep. at the top. I hate to say that out loud, but it's true.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, the third thing most humans want is clean clothes. And the people that need laundry mats and laundry facilities, when times get tough, they don't need them less. Need them the same and or more. I mean, I don't know if you've seen. I was at Lowe's the other day, and it's like $1,200 for a new washing machine now. I mean, the demographic that needs a laundromat isn't going out and spending $2,400 on a washer and dryer when times get tough. It's like, okay, so it's a recession-resistant business. It's also an inflation-resistant business in that we can reprice our stores in about 30 seconds. Going back right. to the mom-and-pop model that have these 25-year-old machines where they got to go up and like go through a series of programming codes and figure out how to change each machine, I can do it from my phone. I right. just change them. 30 seconds. Okay. Well, you know, like last year, I think our utility prices doubled in the span of like 30 days. It's like, well, I mean, this sucks. I hate to do it, but you got to keep up with what's costing us money, and we need to stay profitable. So you got to raise prices. I think that's the other neat thing about it is that we have that flexibility. We have a $0 accounts receivable, which is also really, really fun, is that we have no dollars waiting out there to come in, even on the drop off and delivery side. It's all prepaid up front.
Right. There's no delinquency.
Zero delinquency. Yeah. Not one penny in delinquency, which is great. And we're not tied to long-term contracts. You know, it's not like I'm not waiting 12 months to reset like some of our multifamily assets are. It's like, well, we just reprice it tomorrow because we need to. So anyway, those are a few things that I think also make it kind of a downside protected asset class that we're pretty excited about, especially right now, just not being real sure where things are going.
Yeah, it's definitely definitely turbulent times. I'm not really sure what's. I don't think anybody knows exactly where this thing's going to go.
Right, indeed not. But that's it, man. Thank you, Tate, for having me on the show today. I do appreciate it.
Sam, it's awesome talking to you as always. Laundromats, we're going to have to take a look. We'll have to talk offline sometime and take a look at some of the things you're doing. I love it.
Sounds great. Thank you, Tate. I do appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much for coming on the show, man. Appreciate it.